Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Sally Elcordi, and welcome to Public Advocate. Today, for the fourth time, I am interviewing Kathy Sinnott about the referendum on the rights of the child, which has been voted on in Ireland. She has a case that is now on to the Supreme Court. This is probably 2 years has gone by since the initial vote, and they have just lost in the High Court, and they are bringing it now to the Supreme Court, and I'm very eager to hear what has happened. She has been keeping everyone abreast. She's up to her 26th notice of the many different elements of this case as they have transpired. Now, what is at stake? That's the question. That's the big question. It is the rights of the child, but what people don't realize, as with so many referendum, and certainly here in the United States legislation, it implies something positive, when in fact it is the polar opposite. What they are staving off in fighting this referendum outcome, the outcome of the vote, essentially forced adoptions and a host of other things that can happen to children once parents' rights have been removed. So it does not give children rights, and it does not give parents rights and families rights. So basically all these rights are handed over to the state instead of to families. And once that happens, as many things as you can conceive of happening to a child, it leaves the door wide open for all of those things. So I have read in the past 10 points of the possibilities of what could happen to children written by Joe Burns, and if I could have laid my hand on them prior to going on air, I would have definitely read them to you, but I will find the initial interview and post those 10 points. They're very significant, very important. Okay, so I'm waiting to hear now from Kathy Sinnott, calling in from Ireland, and I'm very eager to pick her up once she does. Okay, well, let me read the letter that she wrote about this latest thing that has transpired, okay, in the High Court while I wait for her to call in. It says, "Dear friends, Thursday, the referendum challenge was in for mention before the Supreme Court. Joanna Jordan describes, Chief Justice Denham presided. She asked how our case was proceeding. We were able to tell her that the judgment in the plenary was to be delivered the next day. We asked for both cases to be run together in the Supreme Court, and she agreed. She said to come back in 2 weeks, and then she would set a date for a 4-day hearing, possibly, in the autumn term, which is October, November. We were very pleased with the outcome." So that is what Joanna Jordan, who is the person who is bringing this challenge. It is basically challenging how public funds were used to sway the voters to vote in a specific way. So public funds were used to encourage people to vote for this referendum and not to provide a balanced perspective or a dual perspective in regard to the outcome. So they have a very strong case in the fact that people were not given a balanced perspective when voting. They only had one perspective, and therefore this was voted in. And Joanna Jordan, I believe, is saying, "I would not have voted for it had I known what the real, true, or what the complete ramifications of my vote were, have voted against it. So this is very important if you're using public funds. And here comes Kathy Sinnott now. Wonderful. Welcome,
hello.
Kathy Sinnott.
Hi, how are you, Sally?
Well, I'm very well, thank you, and I'm very excited that you're going to the Supreme Court. This is the last stop, am I right?
That's right. We've had the two cases to do with the children's rights referendum in the High Court. And as expected, though we always, you know, I mean, hope springs eternal, as expected, the High Court judge, who is a recent political appointee, was negative in both cases. But we have never banked on him anyways. It has always been the Supreme Court. So we're really hopeful, and we're on our way to the Supreme Court. We'll be given a date in the next week or two. For a hearing, but the Supreme Court have indicated it will be the autumn before they will hear both cases together.
Now, the ramifications of this are twofold. One is what will happen to the children of Ireland, yes vote is allowed to stand, and the other is what will happen to all future referenda if this is allowed to stand with an unbalanced public use of funds to present prior to the vote.
Well, that's right. I mean, this case, we have challenged the result of the children's rights referenda, and this is a referenda that very much was putting the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child into our Constitution, forcing our Constitution into compatibility with this incompatible referenda or convention that came from the UN, which we have very strong support for family in our Constitution, and the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child really substitutes the parents with the state, that the state becomes, for all effects and purposes, the state makes the decision about children and even the main decision, which is who will raise children. So we have challenged this. If we win, the result will be declared null and void. Presumably there will be a rerun of the referendum. Also, what's very vital, there are two issues, as you say. One is to protect children and protect parents in their God-given role of protecting children. The other is also because the state has cheated in every important referenda, which is most referenda, not that some aren't important, but some they do have less of a stake in. But every referenda that the state considered important, like particularly the European referenda, they have cheated in every one of those in the same way as they cheated in the children's rights since the mid-90s. We have documentation on every referenda. So when we were taking this case, of course, you always have to be very careful when you take a case that you don't risk making things worse. And we realized that, at this stage, the government cheats every referenda. So we weren't going to make it worse by challenging them. But we did have the hope and the very good hope, because the Supreme Court had identified them cheating in the children's rights referenda, that we had a good hope that the Supreme Court would give us a good result in this, and in which case we will have put a real break on government cheating. I'm sure they'll come up with other ways, but certainly the way they have been cheating in referenda for the last, well, since the 90s, they would have to abandon.
Well, there's something in regard to UN treaties that is very disturbing. We, as you know, had the treaty come before our Senate we, unlike the Irish people, the United States, we have to appeal to our senators to vote whichever way we wish them to. And they had voted against the Convention on the Rights of Disabled People. It was our lone success that year. However, I understand it is back. Can that happen?
Well, you know, this is something that we were very shocked at in Ireland. The thing about these post-democracy democratic governments, right, is that if they don't get the right answer, they just keep coming back. They don't respect the processes, either referenda or the legislative processes. They just want what they want. So your president often does executive orders where he bypasses, you know, the Congress altogether. But even in a case like this, they just say, well, we'll just keep forcing it through until they finally give us the right answer. And we had that in Ireland, where first with the divorce referendum, where they just brought it back and they indicated they were going to bring it back as many times as it took. And then in the Nice Treaty, the European Nice Treaty, where they brought it back as well, and they said, well, you have to vote again. We know you wanted to vote yes, but you made a mistake. And then in Lisbon, an overwhelming no, and they brought it back. And I remember being in Brussels in the European Parliament, and one of the kind of lead MEPs, as he would have considered himself in this area, his comment when I said, you know, well, don't you dare bring it back a second time, you know, and make us vote again. His thing is, well, it's not a question of a second time. We're just asking ourselves how often we have to bring it back till we get our yes. So this is all post-democracy. And this is the thing about this case, is we're insisting that we never agreed to post-democracy. We have agreed to sovereignty of the people and that they have to respect us. And we feel, we have confidence that in this the Supreme Court will support us, because 2 years ago, in the case that our case is based on, the McChrystal judgment, they did support it and they made it very clear that referenda were to be respected.
I see. So the referenda is not to be voted on yet again.
Well, we have to, it depends on what happens in the Supreme Court. But we have a lot of confidence that the Supreme Court is going to uphold the sovereignty of the people. If they didn't, they would be contradicting their own judgment, which is only a year and a half old.
Right. The McChrystal
case. That we base this on. Yes, the McChrystal case. But it is, it's a very bad sign, as you're saying, in the U.S. when the Senate votes against it and they just decide to bring it back. You know, that just shows this kind of complete arrogance, you know, that
Well, I'm at the point where I'm starting, I ran for Congress myself. I remember saying, I will oppose all legislation, you're welcome. And thus, and they wouldn't print up the cards. I thought it was very interesting that they wouldn't print up my cards, but that's really, this is where we're at with these treaties. Just oppose all of them. If you can drum into the minds of the public that these do not serve us, and if you oppose all of them, you're going to be making the correct decision over 90% of the time. Perhaps that's what they've left us with, is just a blanket oppose everything.
Well, yes, because for one thing, these international treaties, they're not being made by you, the people of America. You know, and often there will be things in these treaties that, you know, for instance, in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, there are some very good things. But none of those very good things are missing from American law anyways. You know, that children must be cared for and must be fed and must be housed. You know, that's already there. That's not missing. It's the other things that they sneak in on the back of those things. So really, you need to make your own rules. You know, you as the people, and remember, the people are the ones that are parents of those children, grandparents of those children, brothers and sisters, future parents. They're the ones that need to be making these laws and these treaties. and not international bodies who are all linked up and who are very much creating just a global governance.
Now, what's the real threat here is what has already transpired in the UK and what has already transpired in Canada, which is forced adoptions. Is this correct?
That's
is
right.
this the largest threat,
oh, that
or
was
are
one
there
of,
other threats?
Yeah. No, there were many issues in this referenda. You know, one of them was forced adoption. One of them was that the state is the one that decides the best interest of the child. Another was that the state, whereas right now it's the family, which includes the child, they are the upholders of the child's rights. And then the state upholds the family and the family upholds the child. And in our current constitution, it's only when the family fails. Then the state must step in and make up for that failure. And if it's a failure of neglect or abuse, well, the state steps in completely. If it's just a failure because the family don't have enough money or because the parents are sick or something, well, then the state steps in and supports and helps the parents so that they can take care of the children. Now, this completely usurps that system where the state directly is in the middle of your family in charge of your children. And the thing is that in the new referendum or in the new amendment, should it be validated, the state can decide that the parent doesn't have to do anything. The parent can be completely innocent. What can happen is the state only has to decide that they might fail. So you don't have to do anything. And as well as that, then there's so many aspects. Another aspect is that the state can take a parent to court, you know, and say, well, we don't like the look of them. We think they wouldn't succeed. You know, a pregnant mother, they could decide she can't mother, right? But the parents can no longer take the state to court for negligence or abuse. And really, in Ireland, you know, the biggest abuser and neglecter of children is the state, you know? And I remember at the time of the referendum, figures had just come out on the number of children who had died in the last 10 years in state care. And it was 6 times higher than the number of than our child mortality rate.
Oh.
So, you know,
oh,
this was just, yeah, this is the situation. And so, and here we're supposed to have, but if you look at the UK, you look at Scotland, you look at these other countries that don't have a constitution keeping this at bay for the moment and see what they're doing. In Scotland, a new law has now assigned every child in Scotland a government person to keep an eye on them, right? So when you have a baby in Scotland now, at birth, your child is assigned a person on the government payroll. That person has access to all that child's school records, hospital records, doctor's records, will know whether or not you vaccinate, will know whether or not everything about your child, and have full rights to come and inspect, etc. And in other words, all parents in Scotland are on probation. And the real parent is this person the parents have never met on a government payroll who is the real parent to your child. And they monitor whether or not you will be allowed to continue to parent. And that is the new rule in Scotland. In the north, we've just had word that they want to really restrict homeschooling, again on the basis of equating homeschooling with neglect. And this comes, again, through this whole UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. In England, there's an article that has just been sent to me today where it's been revealed that many mothers, thousands of mothers, have suffered multiple child confiscations. In other words, the minute they confiscate one child, they're at the delivery ward waiting for any other children that woman has. And they've just revealed this recently, that something like 7,000 mothers have experienced multiple, and one judge was saying in some cases up to 14 children have been taken from mothers, that there have been mothers who have lost 3, 4, 5 children and they have never been allowed to even try to raise a child, that it's just been decided that they cannot be mothers.
Well, this is such a glaring violation of all things family. It is staggering. They have defined, have they, the best interest of the child?
Oh, they weld this as a stick over parents.
But have they defined it? What do they mean by that?
Oh, no, the best interest of the child is not defined. The best, either in the Irish Amendment or in the UN Convention. The best interest of the child, all they have defined is who decides, and that's the state and the agents of the state. That's why when people go into the secret courts to try to keep custody of their children, the judge listens to the social worker, not the parents or whoever the parents bring as witnesses. The judge has to listen to the social worker because it's the state and the social worker as the agent of the state who is empowered to know the best interest of the child. So by definition, it isn't just judges are inclined to believe in their professionalism. No. The case is that judges are, this is the representative of the state, and this person is the oracle for the best interest of the child.
Is there any financial incentive? I have actually heard that there are financial incentives here in the United States for the removal of children. Is this applicable where you live? And I don't have proof where I live.
That I don't know, because we don't have forced adoption yet in Ireland. That cuts out a whole money stream. So in other words, when you confiscate children, you wind up putting them in care, and that costs money and all the rest. They still do it, but it costs. Whereas in England, where they do have forced adoption, where babies are being taken from the maternity hospital, where the law, on how long a baby has to be in care keeps getting reduced, so that basically you can place them with parents fairly quickly, with foster parents or adoptive parents very quickly, then it puts a whole different complexion on it, because you may not, I don't know whether or not you it may be illegal to pay a social worker, and yet for a local authority to be getting parents that will pay the legal fees for the adoption, very generous legal fees, pay the whatever the fees of the health authority for their services or whatever, well, that takes a big burden off health authorities. And the more money health authorities have, the more that they can put into pensions and, jobs and pay rises and everything like that. So I'm not exactly sure where the money stream is, but I would guarantee that if you, and in fact this has been reported on, that if you follow the money, these children tend to go to wealthy parents, to politically favored parents, or to, in many cases, relatives or friends of health workers.
Well, in terms of money and incentives and things of this nature, I just want to say that here in New York City, the health department has a 1.2% cap on exemptions for vaccines, and my point being, legislators no longer need to get monetary gifts to support their campaigns or what have you. What they need to get is an exemption. So I'm wondering,
yes,
will the legislators who push this forth, will their children then not be subject to what all other children will be?
Well, in the UK, it was interesting because the MP that has looked at forced adoption in the UK has really noted the amount of children that are from ethnic backgrounds, poorer families, from, you know, the amount of children from addresses that weren't very upmarket. And it's interesting because a story finally made the papers when a very well-educated, very politically active member of the Conservative Party found herself in this situation of her child being taken away because she said to a GP, her normal GP wasn't there, general practitioner, family doctor wasn't there, and a substitute was there, and she mentioned that she was having a little bit of a struggle with depression. Well, they came in and took her child. Now, usually they wouldn't take the child of a well-educated professional woman with connections, but obviously this doctor didn't know this woman and maybe didn't actually recognize her address as being upmarket. And because of that, the story actually made the papers and a big expose and an investigation started. But had that been a poor woman who generally we would be talking about, it would never have made the papers. So,
well,
we
have the National Defense Authorization Act here, which is what got me active to resist this, is that not only can you be identified by someone you will never know who has pointed a finger at you, but you must then be disappeared permanently here or abroad. And this pertains, there's no age limit on it, and it just screamed child trafficking to me. I know that
yes.
In the traffic market, white children bring a greater price than dark children, and I can't help but wonder, with Scotland and the UK and Ireland all subject to this, Ireland, if you don't win, they too are subject to this. Then I see a very serious problem in regard to trafficking as well.
Well, you know, we have to remember there are two kinds of trafficking. There's illegal trafficking and there's legal trafficking. And, you know, there's illegal trafficking and, yes, there's a real question over when you have a forced adoption, when your child's confiscated, and once that child is gone, you're never allowed to know where that child is, certainly not for during the lifetime of the child. And you can't get that child back. So we don't know what happens to those children, you know. But I think whether they're illegally trafficked or legally trafficked, in many ways, it's not, I mean, okay, illegal trafficking, we're thinking of sordid back streets and things like that. You know, we're thinking of a slavery, et cetera. But we shouldn't discount the horror also of legal trafficking, you know, where a child is, you know, maybe a very gifted little two-year-old is spotted at the daycare center, you know, someone says, oh, you know, that those poor parents are never going to be able to give this child the opportunities, and the child then is taken away. Well, that's cruelty. It may not have the sordid back streets of an illegal trafficking situation, but when that child is placed with strangers, you know, whether we're talking a mom and a dad or two dads or whoever, when that child is placed with strangers who happen to have a lot of money and a lot of clout or whatever, that's trafficking. You know, okay, it's legal because the law is so wrong, but it's trafficking all the same. And it's cruel.
Well, also the issue of homeschooling, you're saying, will be looked at, is frowned upon. This is something I am promoting here because it's maybe the only way parents can protect their children from the poisoning of vaccines. So I am promoting that. Yeah, so now that is being frowned upon, and what
well,
is
in Northern Ireland, this news has just come from Northern Ireland, that there is a move in Northern Ireland to put together, to have the Education and Library Boards, there are five of them in Northern Ireland, to give them the power to just walk into any home of homeschoolers, to give the homeschoolers a curriculum that they set, and various other things, and then give them the power to you know, kind of, you know, condemn the homeschooling situation if they don't follow their curriculum, et cetera. So the proposals have been made, and I think there's a one-week consultation that will be over on Friday to try to get them to back off on this.
Well, our children are so imperiled. It is just unspeakable. What can people do to help you?
You know, first of all, I think it's awareness. What can they do? First of all, it's awareness. Remember that there has been a real anti-child agenda for decades, you know, and many people now, you know, people who felt having a child is terrible and have really promoted abortion and they promoted, you know, family limitation and all of these things for so long, and suddenly they realize they're getting old. That whole 60s, 70s generation is getting old. And they know they have no future without children. But they don't have the children. It's our children that they want. And so they're now looking at how to continue their agenda. And the only way for them to continue their agenda is to take our children, to take their minds and their heart. And they do this through school. They do this through media. They do this through all kinds of means. But especially more and more, the velvet glove is coming off the hand. They are doing it through legislation and policy where when parents, because parents have countered this with homeschooling, with all sorts of ingenious ways, because parents are there to protect their children. And so what you have are now the state getting heavy-handed with parents that aren't naively handing over their children. And so what can people do? Certainly, start being aware that your children, your grandchildren, your nieces, your nephews are very much pawns in a global agenda and, you know, really question anything like this. Protect families, either your own or the families near you, the families in your neighborhood, the families in your family. Protect their rights. And in terms of Ireland, please pray, pray, pray that the Supreme Court will do the right thing and uphold the sovereignty of the people of Ireland, because if they do and if we rerun this and if we can defeat this, you know, this is going to be a major blow. It'll be the first country that will have said, no, our constitution will not allow, you know, much of what's in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. So I think, you know, it will be a victory for democracy itself, and it will also, you know, hopefully be something that protects children and begins to reverse this. But we need lots of prayers for that. And if anyone wants to help it financially, they can absolutely do that as well.
Yes, and I will post all the information about how you can help financially in the comment area directly below the video, so anybody who wishes to help can. But I would like you also to state, because this is kind of really important, the Irish people are the only people who can vote directly, not through their legislators, directly on referenda on UN treaties. So would you like to tell us why that is? Why only the Irish people?
Well, you see, we have a very unique constitution. And in fact, there are some other constitutions like that, and most of them have copied Ireland. And the power in Ireland rests with the people. It doesn't rest with the queen, with a queen or a king or a legislature. The power of Ireland rests with the people. And we, the people under God, that we say, we have that power because God gave it to us. And that we give government power and we can take it from them. And that in all matters, in all serious changes and matters of governance, the Irish people are the ones that decide. And so we vote on European treaties. We should have voted on the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. And from the beginning, the UN committee have been demanding that we change our constitution because our constitution contradicts it. And so the way the Irish government got around it is they just passed it through very low-key, never told the people about it, and have been kind of running it in the secret courts for 20 years. Now they want to adapt our Constitution to allow it. But this is going to take a referenda, and so they cheated in the referenda. So hopefully, if we get a rerun, we'll have a proper battle. But Ireland, the people rule. But it had become a bit of a joke because in referenda after referenda, the government was cheating, forcing revotes and things like this. So this case, as I say, is very dual purpose. But the front line of the case is to regain the right of a fair and free referenda for Ireland, for the Irish people.
Now, you just had the case heard at the High Court, and the public was allowed to attend. Am I correct about this?
Oh, yes, because the secret courts are family courts. They have what's called an in-camera rule where there can be no publicity, and the excuse for that is to protect children. But, in fact, it has done the opposite. But
and parents are not allowed to speak about what goes on behind those closed doors. So
well, that's right. They're in contempt of court, and they're terrified that they will never see their children again. The High Court cases, Supreme Court cases, are always open to the public.
Well, that was my question. Can the public come to this Supreme Court case? And I'm glad to hear they can. Very important.
Yes, they can. And in fact, in the High Court, on all the really important days, there was generally a whole, line of people in attendance watching and keeping an eye on things.
I would like to bring up one of the points that was in Joe Byrne's list of 10 things that can happen to children if this referendum were to have passed legitimately, in other words, with the public completely understanding both sides of the issue.
If the result is validated.
Right, but he had mentioned that or perhaps it was you who mentioned, that there are countries that have passed the rights of the child where children are being murdered. So they're protecting your rights but not your life. As I always say,
Well, that's right, and we see Belgium as a country that has taken the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child to its logical conclusion. Belgium has now legalized the murder of children, euthanasia of children, that children have a right to decide when they die without parental interference. That death should be, that death would be a matter between a child and their doctor. And that where a child can't decide, say in the case of a baby or a very disabled child that can't indicate a decision, that the parents and the doctor, in other words, the doctor representing the state in Belgium, will decide. And if the parents don't decide, the doctor can still do it. So, this is straight out of the UN Convention, that the child should have a complete right of privacy, which includes the right to die without parental, with parents being named in particular as not infringing the right to privacy in the UN Convention. So they're just taking what's in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child to its logical conclusion.
And how old does a child have to be to make this decision? Is there any age limit?
No, the legislation doesn't have an age limit, because what it does is it allows where a child can't make a decision, it allows the doctor or the doctor and or parents to make the decision on behalf of the child.
Well, I know a lot of children.
But of course, the parents
accept vaccines for a lollipop. Perhaps the lethal injection comes directly after the lollipop.
Well,
wow.
This is it. When you realize how much, when you look at disability, there are some disabilities, some disabling conditions that have come way down in occurrence. But so many are in epidemic. They're just like helium balloons going through the, rising up. Many autoimmune conditions are increasing and increasing in incidence. So it's kind of very, very worrisome that governments are now giving children, that is, doctors and government agencies, the right to kill children. Because children are very influenceable, especially when, you know, the doctor, when the parents are not supposed to be interfering with such a decision. So, you know, there are so many damaged children in a world of, you know, insecticides and toxic everything and vaccines, etc. So many damaged children that you almost wonder if, you know, this is budgeting or medical rationing, you know, in another form.
Well, it's natural immunity rationing and a big push from the pharmaceutical companies. But I had actually heard that if children in Belgium and in the UK are not thriving, that they can be deprived of water, which I understand takes 10 days.
That's right. That's right.
For a child to die. And all I can say is any child that's in the United States who is vaccinated at birth would be not thriving instantaneously. So I don't know if they vaccinate children the day they're born in the UK and in Belgium, but if this is the case, then they are creating a situation where the child cannot thrive and then depriving them of water. So this is...
Well, that's true. I mean, in the UK, they have this thing called the Liverpool pathway, and it's a medical protocol to be used in the last hours of life when you no longer are able to take water or food. You know, when your organs have shut down in the last hours of life, this, you know, the Liverpool pathway is a way of, you know, making you more comfortable, et cetera, you know, in death. Because if once your organs have shut down, if people keep trying to feed you, you're going to create, you know, real discomfort and things like that. But what's happening in the UK, a big scandal all last year, it was very much in the news, is that people who weren't dying were being put on the Liverpool pathway, so that it brought on organ failure. So rather than it being the correct medical procedure for the last few hours, it was a procedure that was being used for the last few weeks, causing untold misery, starvation, dehydration, and causing death.
Well,
and
this is what I'm saying.
For children and adults.
Wow. Well, Kathy, I'm exhausted because I live this every day as you do, and I'm sure you are absolutely wrung out from all the
effort. Well, I'm actually very hopeful because I'm very, very hopeful that our Supreme Court is going to do the right thing. Now, and I don't think I'm just being a, you know, rose-tinted glasses optimist. You know, the same Supreme Court did the McChrystal judgment and would have to contradict itself not to give us some measure of success in this, if not full measure of success as they did in McChrystal. So I'm actually quite hopeful in this. You know,
wonderful.
We got a totally negative decision in the high court, and people were like, oh no, and I was like, no, that's okay, you know, it was the second
best
outcome.
Well, they also seemed to help you in the fact that they deliberately excluded things, as they seemed like, it seemed like a biased decision in reading
the
letter.
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, the best decision would have been that the judge recognized we were right and gave us everything, right? You know, the referendum result was invalid and, you know, government can't cheat and blah, blah, blah. You know, if he would have given us everything, that would have been the ideal. But the second best was that he gave us nothing, because there are very, very important arguments that have been lodged in the High Court, not least of which was the fact that if we lose this case, we will never have a fair or free referenda again, right? So by giving us nothing, the Supreme Court is going to have to give us something. Whereas if
Thank
he
you,
had
Kathy
given us...
Finnett, I would like you to give a way people can contact you.
Oh, well, they can always get in touch with me personally through Kathy Finnett, K-A-T-H-Y, sinnott@gmail.com. And I can start sending them updates on the referendum if they like.
Wonderful. And we only have a few seconds left if there's anything you'd like to say in closing.
No, just I'm optimistic. I would really love prayers, and any financial support would be great as well.